Okay, well, Malin Bakodesh, going up in the world here, and slowly. And we come to the Parsha of Yisro, and of course, Yisro has a great distinction as a Parsha named after him, although there are less noble people who have Parshas named after them. But Yisro begins, of course, the center of the Parsha is Matan Torah, the revelation at Sinai, and yet it's all introduced with Yisro, Vayishma Yisro. Rashi has a well-known comment, short, but it generated much comment itself. The Pasuk states, to begin with the Pasuk itself, Vayishma Yisro, Kohen Midyan, Chosen Moshe, Yisro, priest of Midyan, father-in-law of Moshe, heard, Eskola Sher Asar Lekim LeMoshe, Uli Yisrael Amo. Everything Hashem did for Moshe, for Yisrael, his nation, Ki Yotzi Hashem Es Yisrael MiMitzrayim, that Hashem took them out of Mitzrayim. And the pasuk itself is actually quite wordy, one could say. It seems to go over the events twice. And with all that, Rashi still asks his famous question, Ma Shemua Shama Uba, what did Yisrael hear? That he came to join Bnei Yisrael? And Rashi answers, Kriyas Yamsuf Umilchemes Amalek. Two things specifically. Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea, Milchemes Amalek, the war with Amalek. And before we get to discuss the significance of those two events specifically, we need to ask, as we always do, why does Rashi say anything? I mean, Rashi gave us two answers, but why is Rashi even giving us one answer? Why does Rashi even perceive that there is a question? After all, the Pasuk says, Yisro heard, and presumably he heard what everyone else heard. And especially as the Pasuk itself seems to proceed to describe the events in a much more general way. Everything. The Pasuk says he heard everything, and Rashi says, what did he hear? So what exactly is Rashi asking? And why does he see that there's more, that there's more to it, to Vayishma Yisro, than just hearing? It is true that, in a sense, everyone heard. And everyone heard. Which means that if you say Vayishma Yisro, it sounds like he did more than hear. If everyone heard and you say Yisro heard, it must be a different level of hearing, perhaps one that leads to action. But there's a very interesting comment with regards to this Rashi, and it's to be found in a short commentary on Rashi. As we know, Rashi was zocha to many commentaries himself, super commentaries. Many write at length, and some have very, very short comments. And one of those, which is on the much shorter side, is the Perush of the Trumas Hadeshen, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, one of the great late Ashkenazi Rishonim. He's much more well-known, I'm sure, for his halachic decisions and also the Minhagim that he records. The Trumas Hadeshen, as far as I know, there isn't one tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshen which doesn't find its way into the Shulchan Aruch, either through the Shulchan Aruch himself or the Ramah, in terms of Minhag Ashkenaz. And yet he has other works, and among them is this brief comment, series of comments on Rashi. And he says a very interesting thing. We take something for granted, namely, the Pasuk says, Vayishma Yisro, Yisro heard. As we know, Yisro is a man of many names. And Rashi, in fact, alerts us to this and discusses it on the word Yisro. Sheva Shemos Nikrolo. He's got seven names. Reuel, Yeser, Yisro, Chovav, Chever, Keni, Putiel. That's from the Mechilta. That's a lot of names. And Rashi then explains the background to some of them. And specifically, Rashi says, he's called Yeser. Ashem she yiser parsha achas patorah. Where does the word yeser come from? He has an amazing distinction that he was responsible for adding a section to the Torah. That is to say, the section of va'atasechazeh, what will be described in the ensuing psukim. He sees Moshe's judging by himself, and he feels it's not correct, and he comments and suggests and recommends, and that's va'atasechazeh. He's got a whole system worked out. people sorry. Alofim sorry, Meo sorry, Asoros. And that's the parsha that he suggested. And to a certain degree was implemented. The pasuk says Moshe heard, not in every respect, but in at least in some type of respect. And that is responsible for one of his names, Yeser. Because Yeser is from the word extra, because he added an extra parsha to the Torah. Okay, that's Yeser. And where does Yisro come from? It says Rashi, Lekeshenis Gair, when he converted, which he did convert, he became Jewish, Vekiema mitzvahs, and fulfilled the mitzvahs, Hosifu lo os achas al shemo, they added another name, another letter to his name, that's the letter Vav, Vav, presumably, and more, and therefore Yeser became Yisro. But this leads us, says the Truma Sedeshin, to a very simple question. Namely, if he's called Yisro when he becomes Jewish, then why is he called Yisro in the first pasuk in the Parsha, where he hasn't started yet? I mean, he hasn't started his conversion. He's still Reuel, or whoever he is. So it's an interesting shayla. We take it for granted. What are you going to call him if not Yisro? But in point of fact, at that time, his name was not Yisro. Rashi gives us the background. He's called Yisro when he became Jewish. And that's why, says Truma Sedeshin, Rashi reacts to the words Vayishma Yisro. If you're telling me that he heard, but you're giving him a name that relates to him becoming Jewish, which he didn't have at that time because he wasn't Jewish yet, it must be that his listening was that which led him to become Yisro. But that's Rashi's question. But what did he hear that led him to towards the Jewish people? Ma Shemua Shama Uba. So it's very, very interesting, especially what could seem more straightforward than calling him Yisro. Historically, that name did not exist for him at that time, but rather it's a characteristic name because it relates to the nature of his hearing. He came to become Yisro. Two observations with regards to this. Firstly, as Mefarshim have pointed out, he is called Yisro at least one time already, much earlier on, and that is in Perek Gimel of Shemos, just before the burning bush. How does it begin? Shemos, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Aleph. Pasuk states, Umoshe, Hayar ro'eh estzon Yisro chose, chosno kohen midyan. Moshe was tending the flock of Yisro, his father-in-law. That's in Perek Gimel. That's a long time, one could say, before anyone became Jewish, and certainly before Yisro. So it's this question is spawned by the observation of the Truma Sedeshin. If his name isn't Yisro, even at the beginning of Yisro, how can it be Yisro in the middle of Parsha Shemos? It's a good shaila. Unless we suggest, perhaps, that specifically there, of all places, he is called Yisro, because the location being discussed there is Har Sinai. As we know, Moshe, he came to Har Elokim Chareva, and Hashem says, when you come out of Mitzrayim, all of you will serve me on this mountain. That's Har Sinai. And perhaps, therefore, of all places to call him Yisro, he is called Yisro there. It doesn't exist yet, but it's already, one could say, Al Shem HaAsid. This is the mountain that he's going to journey to in the fullness of time to become Yisro, and therefore he already has that association there. Another question, though, which brings us back to our parsha, is the Torah already calls him Yisro, even though it's not his name. But what's very interesting is he calls himself Yisro, even though it's not his name. And that is very interesting, because Yisro has not yet become Jewish. We assume that he does not have Rashi's commentary, which means in Pasuk Vav, Vayomer Moshe, he says to him, Ani chosencha Yisro ba'ilecha, I'm your father-in-law, Yisro. How does he know he's Yisro? That's built on two developments. Number one, he's going to add a parsha to the Torah. That hasn't happened yet. He hasn't seen Moshe judging the people yet. And then he's going to get another letter when he becomes Jewish. I mean, that's a lot of pre-knowledge for someone. And once again, one must say, but it is important to note, that it is possible that he never called himself Yisro, as if to say, when he says, I'm your father-in-law, it could be that the name he used was something else. But then, because how does he know he's Yisro? But the name the Torah gives to his message that he's sending to Moshe is already Yisro in part of the Torah's description of his journey. But that raises many very, very interesting questions about the Torah's use of names. And there's a lot of before and after here, a lot of food for thought there. But this all comes again from the Trumas Hadeshin's comment on the well-known Rashi. And it's always the Rashis that are well-known that beckon to become better known. Another response or comment on this Rashi comes from the Kotzker Rebbe. And he draws our attention to the fact, if we know a bit of the background, and as we've mentioned so many times, much of Rashi, if not most of Rashi, is actually from Chazal. That is to say, these are not Rashi's comments to the extent that these are his own suggestions. Rather, they're based in Chazal. We call it Rashi because these are the comments that Rashi selected from the entire corpus of Chazal. You've got all of the Gemara and all of the Midrashim. If Rashi bore everything, we'd never finish the Parsha. You need more than 1 week for sure. So Rashi selects, and that's why it's called Rashi. In other words, the pieces of Chazal that Rashi chose. And moreover, sometimes Rashi presents them in a way which does give commentary because it's a little different than the way they are found in Chazal themselves. And here's a good example. Because the question of Ma Shemua Shama Uva, what did he hear that he came, is discussed by the Gemara in Maseches Vachim, in Daf Kuftet Zayin. There, interestingly, the Gemara gives three answers, but they are three differing opinions from Tanoim. Some say Kriya Samsuf, for whatever reason they chose that one. And others say Milchemes Amalek. And still others, which didn't make it into Rashi, is that he heard about Matan Torah, which is interesting. And that's why the Gemara mentions it, because that leads you into the discussion as to when Yisro came. Did he come before Matan Torah, after Matan Torah? There's many psukim that need to be discussed. We've had that discussion on a different occasion. Rashi doesn't bring that one in. But he does give entry to the first two, Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes Amalek. But what's interesting is, in the source, in the Gemara, those are presented as conflicting opinions, or at least differing opinions. Different people say them. One says it was this. One says it was that. And what does Rashi say? It was this and that. Kriyas Yamsuf, Umilchemes Amalek. No one said that in the Gemara. No one said both. But Rashi puts them together, and that, again, you see Rashi's fingerprints. Even on the comments that he quotes, he has an eye on explaining the psukim. And what is the meaning of this, of the combination of these two things? Are they in any way related? Kriyas Yamsuf, Milchemes Amalek, says the Kotzker Rebbe. They are related, and it's specifically the combination of these two things that led Yisro to come to the Jewish people. After all, let's ask a simple question. Yisro hears about Kriyas Yamsuf, and Kriyas Yamsuf means, in a sense, it should change things. If you hear about Kriyas Yamsuf, so life should never be the same, because you've heard how HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes in nature, what it says about him as guiding nature, and maybe what it says about your relationship with him. No question about that. However, the truth should be able to change a person without that person necessarily uprooting themselves, journeying to the place where those people that it happened to occurred, and joining them. I mean, that's another step. And why should it need to happen? Surely the truth has no borders. The truth has no boundaries. You can get the message from Kriyas Yamsuf and stay at home. Take it to heart at home. Home is where the heart is. So that's where you can stay. But Yisro did not stay at home. He came to join the Jewish people. And why did he do that? Why did he not rely on himself to be able to absorb and fully implement, shall we say, the relevant messages from Kriyas Yamsuf in Midian? And the answer to that, says the Kotzker Rebbe, is Milchemes Amalek. Milchemes HaMolek is very revealing because it tells us that the fact that the truth is out there does not guarantee that people will act accordingly. It still very much remains a question of how you handle it, how you react to it, how you are either comfortable or uncomfortable or intensely antagonistic towards it. As if to say, if the war with Amalek is their response to Kriyas Yamsuf, what does that tell you about people and truthfulness? They're only as truthful as the truth that they're prepared to let in. And Amalek are not prepared to let any in. They're prepared to go to war over it. At that point, Yisra realizes that it is an overestimation of anyone's capacities to say, give me the truth and I'll carry on where I am, and I'm pretty sure that I'll implement that which needs to be implemented. Not at all. You see that environment is decisive, and Yisro is therefore worried. He's got the message of Kriyas Yamsuf, but if Amalek can go to war to eradicate it, for the average person it could certainly dissipate or fade, and he doesn't want it to fade. But that's why when he realizes through Amalek that the truth needs to be nurtured and it needs to be given an environment where it can take, he realizes that he needs not only to listen to the message, but actually come and join the Jewish people and become part of that environment. And that indeed is what he does. That's a very interesting comment, quite different, or one could say more correctly, responding to a different aspect of this short, this brief comment of Rashi, Mashmu Ashama Uba, Kriyas Yamsuf, Uvulchemes Amalek. Well, as we move closer to Aseres Hadibros, I just want to make reference to, it's a well-known comment, and it relates to Perek Yutes Pasuk Zayin, which is yet the preparatory stage before the Aseres Hadibros. Perek Yutes Pasuk Zayin. Pardon me, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Pasuk Yud Zayin. So the Pasuk reads, Vayotze Moshe es ha'am likras ha'elokim en ha'machane. So Moshe takes the people out to meet Hashem, towards Hashem. Vayisyatzvu betachtis ha'har. And they stood at the foot of the mountain. And here too, Rashi gives us two perushim. Always, where possible, Rashi will respond with the pshat. As he says, Anila bosi ela l'pshuta shamikra. I want to give you the straightforward reading, straightforward understanding. Where necessary, he'll also bring in Medrash Agada. Ula Agada ha'miyashev es ha'pshat. And when he brings both, the question will always be, why was Rashi not satisfied with the pshat? We're not going to go into that now, but Rashi, suffice it to say for our purposes, that Rashi does bring both. Betachti Sahar, what does it mean, Betachti Sahar? Says Rashi, not to forget, do not skip over this stage. Lefi pshuto, berakli ahar. The pshat is at the foot of the mountain, simple as can be. However, for various reasons, Rashi feels that one also needs to bring in the well-known statement of Chazal and the Gemara, Umidrasho, Shiditlashar Mimakomo, Venechva Aleim Kegigis, the mountain was suspended over them. And that Rashi does not fully quote the Gemara in the words of the Gemara. He's quoted what he needs. But as we know, this was an ultimatum of sorts, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu suspended the mountain over them and said, if you receive the Torah, well and good, and if not, it's all going to end here. Shamtei Kvuraschem. And again, it's a very well-known comment from Vayisatzu Betachti Sahar, and equally well-known is Tosus's question. Namely, why is this necessary? Aside from the fact of what does it mean, but why is it necessary? And the background to that question is, Bnei Yisrael have already accepted the Torah. They've already said Naaseh or Naaseh V'Nishma, whatever it is that they've said by this stage, but they've said yes, they haven't said no. If they said no, so then there's room to say, well, you're not allowed to say no, that's not acceptable, and then things need to move to another level. But if you say yes, so why not leave it at that? And that, in one sentence, is Tosus's question: what is the meaning of forcing Bnei Yisrael to receive something that they've already received, or to accept something they've already accepted? And there are many, many answers to that question. But what is interesting is, and just the comment that I'd like to refer to here, is that there is a certain premise behind the question, namely that this was another thing that happened. It was another part of the episode there, when they came and then Hashem suspended the mountain over them, and Tosus asked why. But there is a school of thought, more among Acharonim, which has a different understanding of what it means that the mountain was suspended over them. And it's possible to say that according to this approach, perhaps Tosus's question is less of a question, as we'll see. And the one who voices it here is Rabbi Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, the Sri De'esh. And he states, again, as do others, that when the Gemara says that Hashem suspended the mountain over them, we are not necessarily meant to understand, or to be given to understand, that, or to picture as the mountain being uprooted and held over them in a physical sense. Rather, it's a depiction of the state of the Jewish people at that time. In other words, what happens if had Hashem held the mountain over them? What does that mean? It means they have no choice. Says the Sri De'esh, from a certain point of view, they had no choice. Even without the mountain being suspended over them, their choice was suspended. But how so? Or why? They can say yes, they can say no. Says the Sri De'esh, remember what they've been through. Remember their experiences of recent times. The whole year of the Makos in Mitzrayim and the Yetzias Mitzrayim itself, followed by Kriyas Yamsuf, and now Milchemes HaMalek. And here they are on this historic occasion. Says the Sri De'esh, who's going to say no? Even without being forced into it, who's going to say no? It's almost force of circumstance, as if to say to anyone who's been paying attention to what's happened, to the miraculous events of recent weeks and months, they couldn't fail to accept. Which means it was as if there was a mountain suspended over them, even if nothing moved. That's how little choice they really had. But we'll appreciate that, according, as we said, according to this approach, then perhaps Tosus's question is not as accentuated, because it was no longer something that actively happened in order to force them into it. It's just a portrayal of their situation, just of their whole state. They were overwhelmed. Who could refuse? But this isn't a contradiction to Na'aseh v'Nishma, or more correctly, it's not an overt act of forcing. It's just the reality as they saw it so clearly. And yet, in the end, it was considered as if they were forced in the following way. Because if you are brought to a point of such clarity whereby you have no choice but to accept, then moving on back into quote-unquote normal life, where you just your faculties of free will and life goes on, so to speak, you haven't chosen enough in order to sustain that type of acceptance. Because if it's born of extraordinary circumstance, it won't necessarily see you through in, yes, extraordinary circumstances. As if to say, if you accepted under conditions where you couldn't say no, so what does that mean for you when you're back in situations where you could say no? Then what? Which means, although this was in a sense the easiest way for the Jewish people to accept the Torah, there was still more to come. Of course, that leads us back to Purim, Kimu v'Kiblu, which is in a much more earthy type of situation, supplementing from a certain point of view the original Na'aseh v'Nishma. But the Sri De'esh proceeds to explain in this vein a very interesting statement in the Gemara. It cries out for interpretation, as we'll see. And it's from the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. And it comments on the pasuk, which is at the end of Eishes Chayil, Sheker Achein, Vehevela Yofi, Isha Yiras Hashem Hitis Hala. And what does that mean? Well, one can only imagine what it means. But the Gemara doesn't let you imagine what it means. The Gemara tells you what it means. And the Gemara explains that it relates to these three terms, Sheker Achein, Hevel HaYofi, and Isha Yiras Hashem, refer to three specific generations. Okay, which is the generation of falsehood? Sheker Achein, grace is false. Hevel HaYofi, beauty is vanity. Which are those? I wouldn't like to think which generations are associated with that. But the Gemara says, Sheker Achein, Zed Doro Shel Moshe. That's Moshe's generation, Sheker Achein. And what's Hevel HaYofi? Zed Doro Shel Yoshua. So the first two generations are called Sheker and Hevel. So then which generation is Isha Yiras Hashem? Says the Gemara, that is the generation of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. And what happens in his generation? They learned Torah through privation. It's the famous statement of the Gemara. Six of them would cover up in one talis. As Reb Chaim Shmulevitz famously stated, there's only one way that one talis can cover six people, and that is that if each person offers it to the other person. When everyone's pulling, forget it. That's not going to cover anyone, and it's not going to end up in one talis either. So that's Isha Yiras Hashem Mitas Halos, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. But what is the meaning of this? And how can anyone call Moshe's generation Sheker and Yeshua's generation Hevel? But the point is, it's called Sheker and Hevel because these were generations of open miracles, which means that what was false in a sense was the people's abiding by the Torah to the extent that they did. Each generation had its issues as well, but the overarching acceptance of Torah. You can't live in a generation of Moshe and not accept the Torah. What are you going to say? No? But that means that your yes, to the extent that it's not a full yes, is called Sheker. And the same is Yeshua. If the sun stands still, so then you're going to say yes, you're not going to say no. And if the walls of Jericho fall down, you're going to say yes, you're not going to say no. And still, you're yes for that very reason. There's something missing from the solidity of that and the authenticity almost of that yes, because it's you're so overwhelmed you cannot but say yes. But that's called Hevel. And if you wish to see, and again, these are the necessary introductions of Torah. It's the easiest way to bring the Jewish people into Torah. But in order to be sustained, you're looking for a generation of what you could call Isha Yiras Hashem. And where does it come from? Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Gone are the open miracles. People are struggling to make a living. People don't have even enough talis to cover one for one. And still they're learning Torah. And that already brings the yes into the realms of truthhood. One could say that it's that you need, HaKadosh Baruch Hu determined, that you need the two generations of Sheker Achein VeHevel HaYofi in order, as we say, to transition the Jewish people into receiving the Torah. But receiving the Torah only finds full completion when you reach a generation like Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. So that is the very interesting comment of the Sridei Eish on that Gemara, and again based on this understanding of a more conceptual, one could say, understanding of Kaf Aleihem Har Kegiges. Okay, I'd like to move to as we come to the Aseres HaDibros, and perhaps to spend some moments discussing one of the Dibros, and that is the mitzvah of Zochor es Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho. And that's to be found in Perek Kaf, Pasuk Ches. Zochor es Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho. And as we know, this yields, and this is the positive mitzvah, Shomor are the negative mitzvahs in the second presentation of the Dibros. Zochor is the positive, and the positive mitzvah from the Torah on Shabbos is the mitzvah of Kiddush. And we would like to, again, certainly a mitzvah worth discussing. It's a mitzvah we have every week. And the question is firstly, or three questions we could ask. Number one, timing. When does this mitzvah apply? Number two, How does one fulfill the mitzvah? On the various levels, on a Torah level, on a Drabbana level, etc., if there are more than one level. And number three, who does the mitzvah apply to? To whom the mitzvah does the mitzvah apply? So again, there's the timing of the mitzvah, the form of the mitzvah, and the scope of the mitzvah in terms of the people to whom it applies. Well, the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim, in the final perek, Arvei Pesachim, Daf Kuf Vav, explains on the word Zochar, Es Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho, states, Zochreyu al Hayayin, remembered over wine, Biknisaso, as it enters. The beginning of Shabbos. That's when the mitzvah of Zochar applies. And what it means is that the mitzvah on a Torah level is to remember Shabbos again in the way that needs to be yet defined. The Gemara says, Zochreyu al Hayayin, to make Kiddush when Shabbos comes in. Of course, if a person didn't make Kiddush when Shabbos comes in, he has a standing mitzvah at any point over Shabbos to make Kiddush. If he wasn't able to make Kiddush at night, so then Kiddush during the day is a Torah mitzvah. It has to happen some point over Shabbos, but it should be in the beginning. If a person did make Kiddush on Friday night, so then Kiddush on Shabbos morning is certainly Drabbanan. That's a Drabbanan extension, Kiddush on Shabbos morning. But the mitzvah is B'knisaso. And that's the halacha. The mitzvah applies once a week when Shabbos comes in. Interestingly, we've noted in the past, Rashi, in his commentary to our pasuk, does not explain that it refers to Kiddush and does not explain that it applies on Shabbos. Rashi actually explains that the mitzvah of Zachar applies when it's not Shabbos, during the week. Keep Shabbos in mind. Keep an eye out for things. If you see something nice, save it for Shabbos. That's how Rashi on our pasuk explains. But once again, one could say that's more of Rashi's pshat understanding of Zohar, but the halacha, the way the Gemara is that it refers to Kiddush Biknisaso. Okay, so that's with regards to the timing. But then the question is, how does one fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush? What exactly does one need to do? Well, as we've seen, the Gemara says, Zochreyu al Hayayin, remember it over wine. That means that a person needs to say something, but it needs to be over a cup of wine. At face value, this is stated or presented as a drasha. If it's a drasha, it sounds like this is the Torah level fulfillment of this mitzvah. And the question is, how does one get from the word Zochor to wine? I mean, Zochor means remember, wine is wine. How did wine make it into Zochor? I'm not sure that wine is always associated with remembering. Tosfos give a couple of possibilities as to how the concept of remembering relates to wine. But Tosfos ultimately are more inclined to conclude, and this seems to be the halachic consensus, that this drasha is not what we'd call a full drasha, as if to say, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Torah level, you need a cup of wine. Rather, as much as it's presented as a drasha, it's what's known as an asmachta. An asmachta, which we've seen on a number of occasions, an asmachta is a situation where the law itself is actually derabbanan. It's not a din d'oraisa, it's not Torah level law, but it is attached to the pasuk, and many would say inspired by the pasuk, perhaps. But having said that, it is not part of the actual din Torah. And that is Tosus's opinion, and again, it seems to be the consensus in the halacha, that on a Torah level, one fulfills the mitzvah even without wine. But then there's this asmachta type drasha, which is a very, shall we say, strong derabbanan attached to the pasuk, to say that it should be over wine. Interestingly, and we've seen two tiers already, the Torah level is to say something, the derabbanan level is to, the asmachta level is to, that it should be over wine. But then what happens? After a person makes Kiddush, so they drink the wine. Is that required? That is certainly derabbanan, says Tosos, and it's not even part of the asmachta. which means that even if a person, I've never seen anyone do this for good reason, because it's not halachic, but if just in terms of the asmachta, to raise a cup of wine and to say something in honor of Shabbos and then put the wine down, once fulfilled the mitzvah of remembering it over wine. No one ever spoke about drinking the wine. But of course we do. But that is certainly drabbanon. It's because a kos shel bracha always needs to be tasted from. That seals the whole event in a way. And therefore, it emerges that the mitzvah of kiddush, anyone who makes kiddush on Friday night, actually goes through three tiers, and all three existing tiers, of halacha. That is to say, whatever they say is the Torah fulfillment of the mitzvah. Zochor es Yom HaShabbos. Because it's over wine, holding a cup of wine, so that's the asmachta. And then when they drink from the wine, so then that is a din derabanan. So that's a great way to start Shabbos. Literally within 1 minute, the person has a deraisa, asmachta, and derabanan, mitzvahs, all taken care of. What is interesting, and I'm not sure if it's that well known, is that of these three, and for in the way that we've presented it, it should be very clear, the priority, without question, are the words. They are the Torah part of the mitzvah. Not only is that the case, but the drinking of the wine, which is part of the mitzvah derabanan, or to partake of the cup of the wine, the cheekful, the malo lukmav, only needs to be done by the person who makes kiddush. Which means, what's the relationship of everyone else? A person sits down to his table, and then there's a number of people around the table. What's their relationship to all parts of kiddush? Everyone has the mitzvah of Zochor es Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho, but only one person makes kiddush. So what is happening there? It's the principle of Shomea Ka'ona. He's motzi everyone. But they, if he didn't say kiddush, they would need to, on a Torah level. So he's motzi them. And that's how they fulfill the mitzvah of Zochor es Yom HaShabbos Lekadsho. What about the drinking of the wine? Only the person who made the bracha over the cup needs to partake from the wine. No one else needs to at all, on any level. Which means that it is not even an obligation derabanan for those gathered to partake of the wine or any wine. Traditionally, they do. But that actually is a fourth tier, which is called chibuv mitzvah, to display love for the mitzvah. As if to say, here's a cup of wine over which kiddush was said, and the person partook of the cup, they'd also like some it's a display of love for the mitzvah, which is not an obligation, but of course, there's nothing more wonderful than that. But it is interesting that in some places, perhaps the notion is reversed almost. In other words, halachically, the words for those that are gathered there around the table, the words are the ikkar, and the wine is not necessary at all. Sometimes one gets the feeling that they may not be paying attention. People might not realize they need to pay attention to the words. He's making kiddush, my participation will be when the wine comes round, and that's my mitzvah. And they don't realize that's actually the reverse of the halacha, because without intent to fulfill the mitzvah, you can't fulfill a mitzvah that you don't know exists. And therefore, it's imperative that everyone know that the actual mitzvah are the words that are being said. And then it's up to them. If they've paid attention to kiddush, they deserve a bit of wine. I think that's fair enough. So that brings us to, in a sense, the three tiers plus the chibuv mitzvah. And yet the question remains, what exactly does one need to say about Shabbos in order to fulfill the mitzvah? After all, the Torah just said, remember it. And even though we assume that remembering means say something, but what is it that you need to say? Well, the Torah doesn't say. And this means that the nusach of kiddush that we have, which of course allows one to fulfill the mitzvah, but on a Torah level, does one need to say all of that in order to fulfill the mitzvah? So the Rambam gives a formula. He gives us the components of what one needs to say. I mean, the Rambam always starts by giving you the mitzvah as it comes from the Torah, and then, as it's then arranged, midrabanan, etc. And the Rambam says, the mitzvah on a Torah level is zichiras Shevach u'kedusha, a remembrance of praise and of sanctity. That's a very interesting thing. Zocher, remember something special about it, but also say that it's a holy thing. Zechiras shevach u'kedusha. Where does the Rambam get kedusha from? Probably from the word lekacho. Zocher is Yom HaShabbos lekacho. And that, in fact, that is not a straightforward pasuk at all, because the simple translation is remember the Shabbos, lekacho, to make it holy. But as we know, it's not us that makes the Shabbos holy. Hashem makes the Shabbos holy. We say Hashem is Mekadesh HaShabbos. On Yom Tov, Mekadesh Yisrael Lahazmanim, because Yisrael and Mekadesh Lahazmanim. But Shabbos, Hashem is Mekadesh HaShabbos. But here he told you lekacho. But what for the Rambam, it translates into what you should say in terms of your formula for Kiddush, something about the Kedusha of Shabbos. And of course, we do all of that in Kiddush, but that's all that you need. There is a famous comment of Rabbi Kiva Eger, and that is that it could be that as soon as you wish a person good Shabbos, he raises the possibility that you've already fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Torah level, just by saying good Shabbos, or Shabbat Shalom, or whatever it is. And the Chofetz Chaim, actually, in the Bir Halacha, in the section of Mishnah Berurah, asks that you don't seem to have said anything about Shabbos. You wished a person good Shabbos, which is a very nice thing to say, but you didn't say anything about Shabbos, not its praise, and not its holiness. How could Rabbi Kiva Eger think that you already yotze the mitzvah that way? But presumably, Rabbi Kiva Eger understands that if you're saying good Shabbos, I mean, you don't wish a person good Tuesday or good Wednesday. If you say good Shabbos, that itself is saying there's something special about Shabbos. That's why you wish a person good Shabbos. And that's why you have this possibility that you've already fulfilled the mitzvah. It's the famous suffix of Rabbi Kiva Eger. Maybe good Shabbos already works on a Torah level. One thing is for sure, and that is that anyone who's davened Ma'ariv on Friday night has certainly said enough to be yotze the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Torah level. He said Vayichulu. He said Mekadesh HaShabbos. I mean, he said everything, almost. Which means, and some people actually say this, that when one davens Ma'ariv on Friday night, he actually fulfills the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Torah level. Now, there's still a mitzvah of Kiddush waiting for him at home, because the Rabbanan said, make Kiddush over wine. He hasn't done that in Shul, one hopes. And therefore, he still has the mitzvah of Kiddush over wine, but that's the Rabbanan. And so, and that's how it's broken down, according to some poskim. The Doraisi you fulfill in Shul, and then the Rabbanan at home. But that led to one of the most famous questions about Kiddush, which was raised by the Noda Behuda. And that is, he may have davened Ma'ariv and been yotzei Kiddush. That may well be. He still needs to make Kiddush on a Drabbanan level. In the meanwhile, let's say his wife is at home, and let's say his wife has not davened Ma'ariv, so then she is yet obligated in Kiddush on a Doraisa level. Because, as we referenced a couple of weeks ago, and it's well known, although Kiddush is a time-bound positive mitzvah, mitzvah sasheshes man groma, nonetheless, and women generally exempt on a Torah level from those mitzvahs, on every all levels, in fact, but Kiddush is one of the exceptions. Where does it come from? Zocher v'shomer. Zocher, as we said, is the positive mitzvah of Kiddush. Shomer are the negative mitzvahs of not doing malacha. And because they were said together, Zocher v'shomer, b'dibur echad nemru, that fusion leads to an equation, which means that anyone who's obligated to keep Shabbos from not doing melacha, which is everyone, is now obligated in Kiddush, which is everyone. So men and women are equally obligated on a Torah level in making Kiddush. Okay, that's very nice. There's just one problem, and that is, by the time the husband comes home from shul, So he's already davened. He's already been Yotze Kiddush on a Torah level. He still needs to be Yotze on a Drabbanan level, but his wife needs to be Yotze on a Daraisa level. So who should make Kiddush? If he makes Kiddush for her, so he is not obligated to the level that she is. So how can he be Motzi her? The Noda Behuda doesn't seem to factor here in the idea of Arevus between the two, that even if you're Yotze Mitzvah, you can be Motzi someone else. He doesn't seem to, others do, he doesn't seem to factor that in. Or see that it would work here, and that becomes who would have thought that the most Jewish thing you could imagine, namely the husband comes home, he makes Kiddush for his wife, would lead to a halachic issue. And yet it does. So how does one resolve this situation? So there are many, many answers that and Rabbi Akiva Eiger gets involved, everyone gets involved. But just two, perhaps, to mention, and with that we'll conclude our discussion for this evening. The Chasam Sofer states very simply that although one has the capacity to fulfill the mitzvah on a Torah level in Shul, because on a Torah level all you need is words, and you have those words in Ma'ariv, in Shul, you can fulfill the mitzvah, but we assume that a person does not fulfill the mitzvah in Shul. Why not? Because the Rabbanan said the way to fulfill the mitzvah is over wine. And therefore, whenever you have a situation where you have a Torah mitzvah, and the Rabbanan said, and here is the optimum way to fulfill it, we assume that a person wishes to fulfill the mitzvah in the optimum way. And therefore, he doesn't want to prize apart the pieces of the mitzvah and say, well, the Daraisa I'll do here, and then I'll just go back at home for the Drabbanan. We assume that he saves, quote unquote, the mitzvah itself, the actual Torah mitzvah, until he's able to fulfill it in the optimal way, over wine, at home, the way the Drabbanan said. And therefore, as true as it is that you can fulfill in Shul, but we understand you need intent to fulfill a mitzvah. And if you intend not to fulfill a mitzvah, you certainly don't fulfill that mitzvah. The standing assumption is that a person does not wish to be yotzei the mitzvah of Kiddush in a way any other than the way the Rabbanan said to do it, and therefore he saves his mitzvah till he comes home, and they're both obligated on a d'oraisa level. That is the approach of the Chasam Sofer, which is very straightforward and peace returns to the region. A very different approach, actually, is from one of the students of the Noda Behuda himself. The Noda Behuda, who's the one that raised the question. If he's Yotze already, he's down to Drabanan, she's still on d'oraisa. So how can it work? One of the great disciples of the Noda Behuda, Rabbi Elezer Fleklis was his name, in his tshuvas, entitled Tshuva Me'ava. So he says that we've already seen that there is no set formula to be yotzei the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Daraisa level. Rabbi Akiva Eiger said you can even say Good Shabbos, and you might a little more than that, but the wife already has more than that. How so? Has she lit Shabbos candles? We assume so. And what does she say when she lit Shabbos candles? Asher Kiddushanu Utsoso V'tzivanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Shabbos. The Tshuva Me'ava suggests that in that bracha, L'Hadlik Ner Shel Shabbos, and again, why are you lighting candles on Shabbos? Because it's Shabbos. And the bracha itself about doing something special on Shabbos, he suggests, could also be for her fulfillment of Kiddush on a Torah level. So they're both down to Drabbanan, and the field is leveled when they come home. By the time he comes home, he's fulfilled the mitzvah in Shul, she's fulfilled the mitzvah by lighting candles, and they sit down to enjoy a mitzvah Drabbanan called Kiddush over wine. Interestingly, again, the Tshuva Me'ava does not factor in perhaps girls who are at home who might not be lighting candles, which means that then if they haven't daven Ma'ariv, so then obviously that would also need to be accounted for, but these are further discussions. So these are some of the highlights, shall we say, of the very wonderful, beautiful mitzvah of Kiddush, which comes from Zohar is Yom HaShabbos Lekacho. We'll leave it over there for this evening.